Hi, I'm Daryl Cagle, and this is the Cagle Cast, where we're all about political cartoons. And today, our guest is Mr. Fish, also known as Dwayne Booth. And he's been drawing hard-hitting editorial cartoons for decades. You probably can get to know Dwayne best through a documentary about him called Mr. Fish Cartooning from the Deep End that's streaming now for free on Tubi and Tubi.com. And you can also see it by paying $3 or $4 to other streaming services. It's great to have you here, Mr. Fish.
Great to be here, Daryl. Thanks.
I've been a fan of Mr. Fish for a long time, and he is out of the mainstream of mainstream media editorial cartoonists because he often does things that are kind of obscene, and that's okay depending on what publication you're in. Here is the Republican Party giving birth to Trump. Tell us about this.
Well, you just nailed it. I wanted to do something, obviously, that connected the buffoonery and the grotesque nature of Trump being born out of a very traditional image, which is the elephant of the Republican Party. And ask that question generally with an image like this: what does this say about the tradition of the Republican Party, and what is going to happen with this monstrosity once it is birthed and given a platform from which to broadcast whatever it's going to broadcast in the name of the Republican Party?
I should say that you sent me about 100 Trump cartoons, and I picked 40, and I didn't put in the most obscene ones, and I took out the four-letter words. But, you know, we have some that are pretty much on the edge of obscene. And here is Trump with his ugly butt. And I suppose that just means that you're seeing through to the real Trump, both with the Confederate battle flag and with his butt.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you're trying to illuminate somebody's identity, you don't necessarily always need their face. That's what's going on here.
Now, I should emphasize again that I have edited these, and I wonder if you would talk for a minute about your audience, because this is not the regular newspaper audiences. We wouldn't have gotten a newspaper to print either of these first two cartoons. And so you're picking your audience by what you choose to draw. Tell us about that.
I tend to draw stuff that I would like to see. Of course, I want to be provocative and unique. And I would even argue, though, that stuff like this actually would be publishable and exist inside something like the Comics Underground movement from the 60s and 70s. Even the alternative press would run things like this back then. So that's the time period that has inspired me since I was a little kid.
Of course, we're living in a time when the alternative press has pretty much died.
Absolutely. Even the mainstream. I mean, I would argue that even the most mainstream, or the idea of trying to produce objective reporting on things, is gone. Everything to me seems as if it's an opinion piece, and everything is argued in favor of what political stance or political team you want to associate yourself with. That has very little to do with straight reporting to me, or even commentary that asks for conversation. Because a lot of my stuff, I try to be provocative and have that moment of, is this obscene? Is this, what is this? That begs a conversation. And I think in order to get to the bottom of understanding politics and how each of us grapples with our responsibilities as citizens in a free democracy, you need to have a conversation afterwards. It's not really about just sloganeering and then reacting to everybody's oversimplified notions about playing politics like sports.
Cartoonists all over the world like to draw Ku Klux Klan hoods. In general, I would say mainstream newspapers won't print anything with a Ku Klux Klan hood in it, no matter what, even if it's an appropriate reference like to Charlottesville. That's frustrating to cartoonists. And, you know, there's a lot of things that cartoonists naturally want to draw that just never get printed. Now, you're living in a different world because you're picking your audience and you've got a limited number of publications that are willing to accept that.
Yeah, I don't do my stuff in search of an audience necessarily. I try to serve my ideas about what I think is right or wrong about the world. And I also try not to pull any punches. If I'm very upset about something, I'm going to express it in the most extreme way I can if I'm very upset. Now, that said, sometimes that's the way to do it. You know, people can then say, yes, I am that angry. And, you know, I'm with you in your pain. We can congregate around our own frustration and our own outrage. That's what this looks like. But there are other art ways you can thread that needle. Here's another KKK sort of reference. And I do agree with you. It is really interesting. Cartoonists really are always attempting to figure out the shorthand and to get their ideas across as quickly as possible, right? So you do want to use things that cue the reader in a way to know exactly what you're talking about. And I do find this the same frustration. If they're saying that it's too bombastic, I would say that it's not quite as bombastic as the thing you're trying to illustrate, which is...
Our perspective on it is that... you know, an important part of the editorial cartooning audience is that all the students in America in 8th grade and 11th grade have this AP history test. And on the AP history test, they have editorial cartoons, and the student is supposed to write an essay. What does this cartoon mean? What is the cartoonist saying? And kids have lousy visual metaphor vocabularies, and these are actually quite difficult for them. You know, the number one email I get is, "Dear Mr. Cagle, explain the cartoon to me. My paper is due tomorrow." And probably the biggest clients we have for our editorial cartoons are the testing services that write the tests, and by extension, the textbooks for the teachers who teach to the test showing editorial cartoons. So we generally think of what we want to do as being safe for eighth graders. And I would say probably a fourth of your cartoons are not safe for eighth graders.
I know. I have to jump in there, though, because I think you and I've had this conversation before. It's funny that you say that, because if there's anybody who is going to thrill to some of the stuff I create, it would be an eighth grader. Because I think that classifying it as not being safe it sounds like a parental decision to me. I guarantee you, you ask any eighth grader who is curious about the world and also curious about politics, I think that they would want to see things that are, you know, quote unquote, inappropriate in a mainstream sense. And so one of the things, too, that you bring up an interesting point about, you know, the reading of cartooning in contemporary times. I wonder how much of that has to do with literacy when it comes to this kind of art form. You know, because if you think about it, I think that most of the way anybody in contemporary society, adults included, the only experience they have with deciphering and experiencing imagery is through advertising more than anything else. And that's very short form and is asking for a reaction. And typically, if it's advertising, it's presenting you with a discomfort that is going to be relievable through purchase. All right. So that kind of thing, when it comes to editorial cartooning, I think our job as cartoonists are asking for, yes, immediate recognition for what we're trying to critique, but also asking for a deeper conversation and more contemplation and deliberation on complicated political and cultural ideas.
Well, tell me about this one. Is this just a simple cartoon that Trump dances with racism in his course of things, or is this a commentary on Melania?
It is not Melania. It is just what you said before. It is the normalization of this kind of prejudicial thinking that had happened during his presidency, and it's still lingering. It's still something that we're dealing with. So turning that into that kind of hatred into something that is a kind of elegance and grace framed around a political leader who is in the White House, all of these things are supposed to be sort of more stately.
Well, I like how the metaphor extends here, because he leads in the dance, and dance is something that you look to practice and get right and be graceful. And all of that in his relationship with these foul people on the far right is pretty ugly, as you show in her face. I think this is a lovely cartoon. But
Thank you.
It's very frustrating that we can't get these things published. I put in a few of the cartoons from our other more traditional mainstream cartoonists that are kind of saying the same thing. This is basically saying the same thing as your cartoon. You know, his association and how he is defined by that, but they just don't get printed because they are having a Ku Klux Klan hat in them.
It is frustrating. So the question is, who is making that decision? I think that there is a difference between an editor making a decision like that. Is that in deference to an audience that might misinterpret this? Or is this something that is actually going to be effective? Because as you and I know, the profession continues to suffer. We are a diminishing species. And I would argue that that's not because the work that we do is antiquated and not effective. I think it's because it is effective and it can start these conversations and it can encapsulate very dangerous situations and things that are going on in society that might incite people to actually do something about it.
And I think I might argue that as print is in decline and newspapers are more and more timid as their audience is smaller and their income is smaller, that the idea of an old lady writing in to cancel her subscription has a lot more power.
I think also literacy when it comes to this art form, because you can do stuff, imagery particularly, since like an image like this, for example, this was about January 6th, has no words. It's something that people, from when I did publish it, said that it was really beautiful and I saw it.
I really should describe these things. You're the typical podcast listener watches the video version, but then they put it on their chest and fall asleep listening to it. So, so this is your Guernica cartoon of January 6th with lots of January 6th imagery. And I should say that this is one of those things like Ku Klux Klan hoods that all the cartoonists love to do. They love to do parodies of famous masterpieces, and Guernica in particular, because Guernica is one of those things that's a metaphor for horror at its most. Cartoonists love to pick the strongest imagery that we can, or that we can get away with. And you are renowned for being willing to pick stronger imagery than others can get away with.
Right. It's also important to recognize that Guernica, the Picasso piece, by some scholars call it the greatest editorial cartoonist that's ever been made. You know, it's because it also looks like newsprint. It's communicating about a very specific incident in history. So it has a lot of the characteristics of what a great cartoon would have. How big is it? It's like, it's huge. It's like 40 foot long, isn't it? So maybe that's where the grandeur comes from for people. You stand in front of it and you know, if it tipped off the wall, it would crush you.
Well, this is really very nice. And this is one that I did. And this was just the Republicans losing the election and being so horrified. And this was back when Obama was elected, I think. And we just got to love Guernica. Guernica really works for us. Here's one by a cartoonist in Greece, Michael Kuntour. And he's doing Gaza. Of course, Guernica is about the Spanish Civil War, but when you're drawing something like the horror of war, that's really what Guernica was intended for. So it's right. Not really an exaggeration so much, but right. I love Guernica. This was one that I thought was fun from Angel Boligan, cartoonist for El Universal in Mexico City. And he's doing Guernica about the high price of insurance. And that's kind of funny. You know, the more trivial the topic that you put the strongest metaphor next to just makes it kind of funny. I enjoyed all of those, and I enjoyed your Guernica.
Well, thank you.
I thought this was a great cartoon. You know, there were so many cartoons about the kids in cages, and this one, I think, really captures the lack of concern and the trivialization about the issue in a way that I thought was kind of charming, yet at the same time trying to be shocking. So I really like this cartoon.
Thanks. Yeah, and part of it, too, was also characterizing how what always appeared to be his attitude towards immigrants, just to call them animals, and like you said, to frame it in a way that looks very benign and childlike. We also recognize this from, you know, the animal crackers that we've had growing up. And to also have the idea that that is normalized and also marketed to a public that is unable to see the tragedy of it is also
Part
of it.
And this is a great and charming cartoon. But, you know, there is something about you, kind of a bad boy persona, I never know when you're going to be obscene, that carries through even to cartoons that are, there's nothing obscene about them, that you still feel like he's edgy, even when the cartoon is not doing a terrible edgy thing. Because this is a cartoon that would have been beautiful if done by any cartoonist, but not so edgy if done by a different cartoonist. I think that's fun. So Captain America about to himself up with a suicide vest.
Well, this, again, like these are images like this, it's hard to talk about. And I would like to bring this into the conversation, not necessarily now, but your experience talking to cartoonists, asking what their images mean. I always feel, and I've seen some of your podcasts, there's always quite often that beat where it's just like, I draw this stuff so I don't have to talk about it, you know, coming from your guests, which I always find really, really great. But yeah, I can, it's pretty obvious, you know, somebody who arguably the most powerful person in the free world. Okay. That's what an American president is tasked with being called. That's the identity of this person. What does that mean typically? Quite often it has to do with the lethality for other people outside of the United States, I would say. When the domestic threat becomes something that the commander-in-chief is perpetrating, that's when it becomes really interesting to me. So during Trump's presidency, many people were very concerned with what was happening to the fabric of the democracy itself. So the threat became something that, A, was being normalized by the office, just because you're supposed to respect the commander-in-chief and you're supposed to do your best to assume that the checks and balances inside of our government are going to keep us safe. When Trump was president, all that started to become very, very, very shaky. And it started to feel like somebody who has the hubris and arrogance of somebody like Trump. He's willing to take down the country with himself to protect his ego. And that's new. I think that's new when it comes to a president.
So you have Trump as God anointing himself as man in the Sistine Chapel.
Yes. And also I needed to have the hand gestures be juvenile and unbecoming of somebody in such a powerful position.
So the fist bump is rather disrespectful to God, who is also him. This is a funny cartoon.
It's also a cartoon that I like doing things that illustrate a feeling more than an idea. You know, once you introduce a religious element into a political element, there becomes a wrestling match that is kind of curious, you know, because some people are going to wonder if it's a mockery of religion. Some people are going to wonder if it's a mockery of the institution of the presidency. Obviously, it's a mockery of Trump, but it's going to be up to the reader to grapple with a little bit of a hot mess with an image like this and figure out why it's satisfying, why it's confounding, you know, why you want to stick with it for any length of time to figure it out. Because I think to one of the points that you were making earlier about when I render a cartoon, sometimes you can feel the edginess in it, you know, that rendered from a different cartoonist might not necessarily be there. I think some of that might have to do with the craftsmanship I try to put into my cartoons, because there is a way to draw this with a simple line and as a much more quote unquote cartoony rendering. But if I'm going to spend like 5-6 hours on a cartoon, when you're looking at art, you recognize that the artist has spent that much time. So a part of the reader's brain is going to say, why did this person think this was important enough to spend that much time working on it? I'm going to actually try to decipher it a little more. I'm going to give it a little more time. So that's one of the things that I consider, depending on what I'm trying to cartoon. Am I going to make this something closer to visually what might look like a piece of fine art? Because people tend to like craftsmanship and they will tend to stand in front of it a little longer than if it were a simple cartoon drawing. So if I can get somebody to stand in front of my work a little longer, it does what I was saying earlier. It sort of begs the opportunity for a longer deliberation and then perhaps a more substantive conversation following the viewing.
You can look at this one very simply, which is, oh, the ego on this guy.
Exactly.
So this is fun. Trump with the Burger King crown and his giant fat belly. I might argue that his body hair should also be golden, light yellow.
Right. I don't know how much time I could spend working on something like that. That would be really, that is funny. But then you've just added at least an hour and a half to my having a But yeah, with something like this, looking at Trump, you always would have the idea the grandeur and the authority of this person is very self-imposed.
You have a caption on this that says, the king of the world trying to decide if he wants fries with doomsday. And the caption is necessary because that changes the view of the cartoon. But it's just a funny image, and I enjoyed this one. So this is Goya's Saturn devouring his children, and Trump is devouring Uncle Sam, as you see from the hat at the bottom. And this is lovely. This is also one of those images like Guernica, all the cartoonists love to draw. We all know this Goya painting. It's an extreme metaphor.
It is. Again, you're right. I think when it comes to the deepening of even satire, I mean, we can talk about cartoons using familiar images to riff off of. But the history of even satire itself, it demands that your reader have some understanding of the past and other forms of communication that communicated horrific images connected to narratives that are very, very, very dark. So if you can bring a modern iteration of something that has the depth and the terror of something like this Goya piece, so much of the work has already been done. And then once again, you're asking the reader to consider Trump as being as monstrous and producing equal horror to what Saturn devouring his son would look like.
He did eat all of his children, though.
Yes, but I think that might be his son.
Okay. I have talked to a couple of other cartoonists who did Saturn eating his son cartoons, and they both had problems with their editors who were not familiar with the painting. Exactly. And when they're getting this image without knowing that it's a painting parody, it is difficult for them to accept why you've chosen this image. I don't recall if they got the cartoon killed or printed, but it was difficult for them to communicate that. And when you're pitching to eighth graders, things like this, we're like, you kind of need explanation, and I'm not quite sure how you do it.
Yeah, you're right. But at the same time, I think an eighth grader would say, again, this goes back to me trying to, you know, render with sufficient craft just to make it, even without that reference, if you can get as close to Goya as possible, because, you know, an eighth grader would see the Goya if they hadn't seen it before and be intrigued. So if this is their first experience with something as ugly and as dark, I'm fine with that. I don't necessarily need the Goya reference to be in here. It adds to it for sure. But if they recognize that Trump is devouring, as you said, Uncle Sam, you see the hat there. So I think the commentary is already there. Yes, it might be deepened by the reference point, but I don't know if that's always going to be necessary. And this is an example of that in my mind.
Here is another Saturn cartoon by John Darko. And look at what a difference the way you draw the image goes towards the horror. And also what a difference it makes coming from you, where you feel like you're always on the edge of being obscene, to something like this, where there's not really any threat of obscenity from John Darko. And I think that's an interesting contrast to a very common metaphor.
This is funny, though. My taste like chicken.
Now, this one's by Hayo from Holland. A lot of these Saturn eating his children are drawings of Putin. I've done a couple of them. I did Saturn devouring Cyprus and Saturn devouring Iceland, where they both had their banking crises, and it looks like the bankers are going to devour these whole countries, which I thought was kind of funny. That's really a more trivial concept to put into this extreme metaphor. And I think the most extreme metaphors are kind of funnier when they're on concepts that are not as extreme.
Yeah. No, that's certainly true. One question I would have for you is, in your experience in sort of gathering these cartoons that have this reference, do you find international cartoonists tend to rely on these kinds of connections more than American cartoonists?
I think maybe European cartoonists or Latin American cartoonists have an audience that knows a little bit more about art.
Right.
You think?
Yeah, I think so. I think that also that many more cartoonists outside of the United States rely on wordless cartoons. I think and I think that's a great tradition to draw on. You don't have to speak the language. You can even be illiterate and you can still understand what's going on.
When you consider that cartoons are intended to be on a printed page surrounded by text, I think they have much more impact than if they're trying to compete with the text around them. So here you have the Rosie the Riveter, We Can Do It. Another metaphor that the cartoonists all use. Here's one from R.J. Matson. But again, yours is harsh, and there's a sense of this is the guy who might be obscene, which you don't get on a standard editorial cartoon, even with the same image.
Right.
I think that's fun. That's both your curse and your asset.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, just to go back to that just really quickly, those last two, that We Can Do It. One of the things that might make me a little bit different than many of my colleagues in this industry is that I always have in the back of my mind the danger that mirth can cripple rage. So I always have to find that it's a balancing act. I don't want it to be funnier than angry. Because when it comes to the stuff that I'm trying to criticize, I'm actually angry. And I think that a way to get people politically involved with something that is perhaps dangerous to the society, I think they need to leave the image a little uneasy. Because if you have the relief of just, oh, that was a good joke, that it's satisfying. Your physiology is being told everything's going to be okay. And sometimes with certain things, I don't think that that is the message I want to put forth. Because as I said, mirth can cripple rage. And I think that rage controlled and, you know, leveled towards organizing and getting involved, you know, not going and tearing things down, is a great motivating force to actually participating in the democracy and also attempting to alleviate some of its pain and fix it.
Well, there's the argument that you're trying to persuade with a cartoon rather than just preach to the choir and share your anger with people that are also angry. And of course, those are the people that appreciate our cartoons the most. But mirth is also helpful in persuading and getting through to someone with a point that they might not otherwise be willing to accept.
It's a definite balancing act, I think.
So here you have Don Quixote. This is another favorite metaphor of editorial cartoonists. So you think that liberty is the windmill that doesn't exist as a monster?
I think that Trump here is seeing liberty as a dragon that is deserving of his lands, not recognizing the fact that A is not a dragon and that it has agency and usefulness as a windmill might in a different location.
Okay, here's one of my Don Quixote cartoons. I did Trump with Pence, and their windmills are all of the election nonsense that doesn't really exist that he was eager to fight against.
And this is Picasso, right?
Yeah, and I think Don Quixote is one of those things that's extra favorite of the Europeans. We see so many Don Quixote cartoons. But here you have a Kool-Aid cartoon. Kool-Aid is another favorite metaphor. You've got a silly cartoon that maintains your edginess, of course. Kool-Aid is the death of Saul, and I like that.
Thank you. I wonder if the Kool-Aid company is just thrilled by the constant use of their product as...
That's got to be frustrating for them. I threw in a couple other Kool-Aid cartoons. They usually don't have much nuance. I thought this was funny. Kool-Aid is a wonderful metaphor, and I don't think the Kool-Aid company deserves it, so that's kind of sad. All I Want for Christmas is a Different Santa. This is very nice.
Yes, and I like his applause there and getting the eagle in there as what would usually be a turkey or some roast goose. Or
there's a theme of Trump killing America in a lot of your cartoons.
Right. Yeah.
Here you have the Trump Cliff Notes dropping their poop. Another thing that we can't get editors to accept is poop in cartoons. And they don't like bodily fluids. Very frustrating because those are things all cartoonists really want to draw, poop and bodily fluids.
Well, it's funny. It's just to get back to that thought. You know Mort Gerberg, I'm sure.
Uh-huh.
So Mort and I have had many conversations. He was great friends with Paul Krasner, who was the editor of The Realist magazine. And Mort and a number of cartoonists working at the time were so thankful for the appearance of The Realist magazine because it allowed them to do poop cartoons and much more edgier work. So he would have his stuff, you know, there'd be stuff in The New Yorker and other really mainstream magazines that had a great deal of stature. And then he and colleagues would just be like, now the stuff we really want to do, it's going to go into The Realist. So there used to be venues where you could actually do both of those things. Not so much anymore.
One thing that seems to be a common experience is when an editorial cartoonist gets laid off or fired from his newspaper job, but they still like to keep drawing cartoons, whether they have a job or not. You know, as these cartoonists all lose their jobs, we don't lose that many cartoonists because they love what they do and they just keep doing it as freelancers. But the
you're aware of the cartoon when they, the book of cartoons that were supposed to be in The New Yorker but were rejected from The New Yorker?
Sure.
Have you seen? So those,
those are better cartoons. You got to wonder why The New Yorker is picking all the worst cartoons. They're just demonstrating that Matt Diffie edited that book, and it's just did a wonderful job. But what I was saying before is that as soon as the cartoonist gets laid off, they draw somebody peeing on something. This is the classic cartoon we all want to draw, is somebody peeing on something else, and they're never allowed to do it until the day after they're fired and they're drawing. They've got to get all their pee out. So talk to us about this one. Trump just about to kiss the political baby of a very racist doll.
Right. He's basically, with something like this, I wanted to, again, acknowledge who he is trying to inspire. What is his base made up of? Who are his biggest fans? And bringing in that horribly racist trope from the past and having him completely, he's either aware and thinks it's beautiful, or he's completely unaware and doesn't know what he's doing. Both criticisms of him, I'm totally fine with.
You're fine with him being unaware?
I'm fine. No, I'm fine with people recognizing the fact that he is either unaware or his villainy is something he's 100% aware of. Either way, he's dangerous.
Yes, but it would never occur to me that he was unaware. He seems to know his audience really very well.
I don't know. I mean, that again, I think that's open to debate. I think that while you may say that he knows his audience really well. I think that his audience might know him better or equally as well. I don't think Trump knows how to get out of his own head. Like that argument where it's just like, well, he's very good at what he does. He's a master showman who does this and that. I never have believed that.
Well, I wouldn't assume any hypocrisy in that. We hear all this stuff about Republicans talking about stuff to the public, but then in private, they say entirely different things. And my feeling is, I'm going to believe whatever they say in public, that's really who they are. Whether they say something else in private, who cares? What you are in public is what you are. And so I believe Trump.
Oh, I believe him 100%. But at the same time, I mean, we also should extend that to the other side of the aisle. I think that when it comes to a politician, I think that there's equal justification in naming that for both sides. For example, I remember when Obama was saying that he was with the question of gay marriage, for example. If you remember at the very beginning of that debate, he was saying, you know, I think that it's a choice between a man and a woman. And he, like any other politician, had his finger in the wind. And when the society decided to move without the permission of bureaucrats and insist on that right, then he had to make the public statement after careful consideration. I've changed my mind basically into this thing. I knew when he said that he was against it, you could see in his eyes that he was not being genuine. He was not against it. He understands that that civil union has credibility and should exist, but he had to play the role of a politician. Remember, a lot of what we hear from politicians is theater. But to your point, I think that when it comes to Donald Trump, it's a little bit different because he white knuckles his buffoonery in a way that other politicians, I don't think, have.
Well, you bring up an interesting topic because I think looking at your work that you were just as tough on Obama as you are on Trump. But clearly you're on the left and you certainly must not have disliked Obama as much as you must dislike Trump. But when you reach for the strongest metaphors all the time, I think looking at your work is just as strongly opposed to Obama as it is to Trump. And one thing I notice among the more mainstream cartoonists is that the conservative cartoonists don't draw Trump and the liberal cartoonist didn't draw Obama. Cartooning is a negative art and you really have nothing but bad things to say about people. But you jumped whole hog into saying all the worst metaphors you could about Obama. So could you speak to that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. And because I'm attacking the chair of the presidency. I don't care who's in that chair. And I think that the placating that happens in that chair and the dishonesty that happens in that chair, in many ways, there's an argument to be made, I think, or at least a conversation that can be made, that somebody like Obama might actually be a little bit more dangerous than somebody like Trump, in the sense that Obama was dashing, eloquent, seemed just very likable. Anybody who would look at him, I would say, you know, with our political leanings, would say that's somebody I would actually like to hang out with. But our responsibility as cartoonists and critics has to look beyond that. Because if there's somebody who is eloquent and likable, who is doing things like perpetuating a drone program that is really, really dangerous, adhering to certainties when it comes to how we grapple with secret surveillance, secret renditions, all of these things that the Obama administration perpetuated, you don't want to do it because you like him. I found that to be one of the hardest things that I needed to do because a lot of people were just like, why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? Also, the fact that he was the first African-American president that we had. You know, that's also something to consider because one of the cartoons that kept coming out when he was elected the first time and then when he was elected the second time had some version of Martin Luther King sitting on a cloud looking down at the swearing in of Obama and having tears of joy run down his face. That to me was a racist take from my perspective. Listen, it's not lost on me the significance of having the first black president. That aside, when it comes to the things that Martin Luther King criticized, the idea that you would have Martin Luther King shedding tears of joy, looking at Obama, particularly when he was elected for his second term, and not look like he'd be capable of criticizing Obama, to me is a disservice to both Martin Luther King and to our understanding of who Obama was. You can't just make the equation that they are both black men and that they are therefore going to be friends. And that's my job as somebody who's cartooning and trying to perpetuate a meaningful conversation about this, says that there is a difference, you know, there is a difference.
I used to work as a toy inventor. And in the toy industry, you never see volume controls on any electronic toys because kids will turn the volume up all the way. And there's no other volume setting except turn it up all the way. And in a way, I think you kind of approach editorial cartooning like a kid approaches a toy. You turn the volume up all the way on everything. Even when there's someone you like more than someone else, your volume is turned up all the way. So that's more a matter of who you are than who Obama is. Here you've got Che Guevara as Donald Trump, and that's fun. And cartoonists love to draw Che Guevara. And here you've got Trump jumping the shark. I think that's a good point because no matter how crazy he was in the presidency, it seemed like every day was getting crazier.
Yeah, so it's every day he jumped the shark. It drove me crazy. And I'm just like, how's nobody paying attention to the fact that this is Fonzie jumping over the shark tank every day? It's neither entertaining nor is it worthwhile to watch.
Well, this is a very nice, epic Biden crossing the Delaware cartoon. I think this is a lot of fun, and you've got a lot of fun things going on.
Right. This I actually did for a German news agency that right before Biden's inauguration, they did a short documentary about the election. And so they hired me to do a illustration that they could show in their documentary. So in the middle of working on it, January 6th happened. So I said, okay, well, I can add the sign that has the arrow to where to find the Capitol. And I can actually add the cannonball headed towards the Capitol. So this was actually a work in progress that I had to make an alteration to right in the middle of rendering it.
Here you have Trump on the ground, just having gotten kicked in the groin. It says, Jesus coming back, but only for a minute and then leaving again. That's funny.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun to do.
What would Jesus do cartoon? I enjoyed this cartoon. I think I'm going to make this into the cover image for this podcast.
this is so funny.
Is he surrendering?
Yes. This was the cartoon when everything, remember we were waiting and waiting and waiting after the election. Just like, how is this going to play out? Everybody was waiting to see if he was going to get a second term or if Biden was going to become president. And I remember waiting and then hearing that Biden had won. And I was on the porch with friends. I went over and a friend of mine opened an extremely expensive bottle of scotch that he had been waiting to open. And we were standing on the porch, toasting each other, drinking back our scotch. And then this popped into my head. And I said, I got to go. I've got a 6-hour drawing that I've got to go.
Well, that's funny. So here you have naked Trump sitting on the globe, taking a selfie, and he's very happy with himself.
Yeah. The world is not probably very happy with this scenario.
The point of this is his expression that he's very happy with himself.
Yeah.
The cartoonists all love to do flipping the bird, giving the finger cartoons. And again, the editors don't like that. So it's another source of frustration, like not being able to draw blood or bodily fluids. But you don't have that frustration since you don't worry about such things. And so here's an expression of your freedom.
Exactly. I also wanted to have him look sufficiently like Mussolini, you know.
Okay, very good. I think this is our last one. You have Trump as the chart of all of the cuts of meat on a hog, and drawing Trump as a pig is a very standard thing among cartoonists. But what made me laugh about this is that you have the anus where his mouth is. And that just struck me as that's where the real joke this is.
Exactly. Yeah. Again, like one of the strengths of cartooning in my mind and the people that I gravitate towards, it's really about trying to figure out how to tell a blatant truth with really little else. I mean, there are ways to fancify truth, but I think the strength of editorial cartooning and satire in general comes from the freedom and the willingness to actually just try to be as blatantly truth-telling and blunt as possible.
I think we're at the end of our time. So what are all the last things you want to say?
I would like to say that if you want to find where you can see these cartoons, go to clowncrack.com because, yes, there is lots of inappropriateness. Share it with your eighth graders that you know, and let's go save the world.
That is the end of our podcast for today. Please remember to like and subscribe wherever you're watching this, and visit Mr. Fish at clowncrack.com. And thank you very much, Mr. Fish. You are a gentleman, and you're always welcome to join our syndicate with 3/4 of your cartoons if you ever choose to. I am a fan.
Yes, long time. We've known each other for a long time. So thanks, Daryl. Thanks for having me on.
Very good. Thanks a lot, Dwayne. And goodbye, everybody.